Webster's Dictionary defines compliance as the action or fact of complying with a wish or command. This is The Compliance Guide.
The Compliance Guide.
As a healthcare provider or healthcare professional, navigating the muddy waters of compliance can get tricky.
And that's why we're here.
Helping you mitigate risk while increasing your profitability. This is The Compliance Guide. Now, here's your host, Sean Weiss.
All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to this episode of The Compliance Guy. As always, I like to begin by saying thank you all so much for tuning in, logging on, and just hanging out with me for a little while today. I have a very special guest joining me, Dr. Brian Fengler, and he is the founder of Evidence Care. Now, as you know, we don't promote, we don't try to push anybody's platforms or products, but when something comes along that is bound to make a world of difference in a provider's life, then it's worth exploring it. It's worth talking about it and trying to figure out how it integrates into the clinical practice of medicine. Very quickly, Dr. Fengler is a co-founder and chief medical officer of Evidence Care. And what makes his story so compelling to me is that he is a board certified emergency medicine physician. And throughout his career, he saw and experienced, in addition to himself, other providers struggling to access evidence-based content that would allow them at the patient's bedside to quickly observe them and start to make clinical determinations as to how they could better serve the patients and their needs. He did his residency at the University of Virginia Health System and moved to Nashville, where he began his music career. Just joking. Although he probably can sing. I don't know. I mean, he looks like somebody who can sing. But he moved to Nashville and he began his practice in the emergency department of St. Thomas Health System. He's also a founding physician and managing director of the Physicians Urgent Care and partner owner of Middle Tennessee Emergency Partners Physician Group. Very well-versed, very dynamic individual. So it's my pleasure to say welcome to the program, Dr. Fengler. Excited to have you here. I know we've got hundreds of thousands of listeners that tune in and listen to this podcast on a regular basis. So want to go ahead and let's go ahead and get this program started. So again, welcome. Awesome. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Sean. I appreciate it and look forward to the conversation today.
Yeah, let's talk first a little bit about your career and you know what got you into medicine.
Yeah, so my mother was a nurse. My father was a school teacher. So I sort of grew up not knowing what direction I would go, whether it would be medicine or education. As it turns out, when I was, 12, 13, 14 years old, I would end up hanging out at the hospital, I think because we didn't have a babysitter. And so would hang around the hospital and, got to see medical procedures, got to see patient care, and really just enjoyed that environment. As it turns out, when I was in college, my brother got sick with cancer and actually ended up passing away of cancer, but spent about 6 months, throughout my sophomore year of college, visiting with him every weekend and seeing the care that the physicians and nurses were taking care of him. And after he passed away and I got back to school, just said, this is the direction I should go and dove in with both feet and haven't looked back.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing, there are moments where I think each of us can look back in our lives and those moments were profound and they kind of took us from not knowing what direction we are supposed to go to having a meaningful purpose in life. Like you, I experienced the loss of my brother back in 2003 and, that really helped to clarify a lot of things for me in my life about direction and how I wanted to engage and have a more meaningful life and more meaningful relationships. So again, you know, my sincere thoughts go out to you because I know how difficult. My brother was about 7 years older than me, and he truly was my best friend. And, you know, he was the one who I always went to. You know, you kind of have that little angel and devil sitting on your shoulder trying to figure out which way you go. And my brother would always be in my ear going, don't do that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's neat to understand, you know, unfortunately, how a tragic situation can really propel somebody into the next phase of their life, doing something that they become passionate about. So, so you went to medical school, you determined, you know, obviously probably through clinical rotations that the emergency room was kind of, you know, that gas pedal for you that kind of got you excited and got you going. And I can understand that. I had opportunities to work in the emergency rooms and work in the surgical theaters and, you know, doing a lot of different rotations and stuff. And I always went back to the emergency room because it was just such an adrenaline rush, you know, especially working in a level one trauma center like I got a chance to do. And so you decided to move into emergency medicine, and you know, you started to build your career from that. What got you interested in the data aspect and the information side of medicine?
Yeah. So, as you mentioned, you know, loved emergency medicine, was very drawn to it. Definitely the energy of it, the constantly something new, something exciting. But I thought the other part of emergency medicine that I appreciate the most was the fact that we get to care for people when they need us the most. They come in at their worst, at their sickest, in their most urgent need for assistance. And so I really loved the fact that, you know, I had the opportunity to take care of patients when they needed the healthcare system the most, and to be able to stabilize them and have an impact on their care. You know, through my practice of emergency medicine and then also, you know, owning several urgent care clinics, just started to realize the gap that exists in healthcare. And it is impossible for physicians and nurses to keep up with the latest evidence that is evolving, you know, every day, every week, every month. Studies show that a doctor would have to read for 160 hours per week just to keep up with the evidence in their specialty alone. And so, you know, I had a few particular patient encounters where I said, you know, geez, wouldn't it be, why is it that we don't have tools that help compile all that evidence and help bring it into our workflow, help us make more informed decisions? And this is the time that the EHRs were just taking off. Meaningful use had just been, you know, signed into law. But saw how those EHRs were being deployed and saw the fact that they were really just, you know, coding and billing systems, and that they weren't really helping doctors and nurses take better care of their patients. And so that was the original mission for Evidence Care, was, you know, develop software tool, plugs into the EHRs, knows all the data that's in the EHR about the patient, and we can help, you know, consolidate and collate evidence that's particular to that patient and deliver it to the physicians and nurses so that they can make the best care decisions and deliver better care to their patients.
Yeah. You know, a program like yours is critical. And the more I've read about it, the more I've looked at it. And the fact that there are, you know, multiple aspects to it, right? I mean, you have an admission care, a care gauge, an imagining, you know, an imaging care, you know, a care pathways. Each of these allows providers in a different segment of healthcare to be able to access information quickly. And I think it's very telling, right? How AI is integrating into healthcare, right? We started with ChatGPT, and ChatGPT continues to evolve, right? And we're finding, even before ChatGPT, right, a lot of folks didn't realize that we had not artificial intelligence, but we had augmented intelligence, right? That's what I like to call it. And, you know, through Frank Cohen, who's a computational statistician, you know, he created a program called Compliance Risk Analyzer that uses data much in the exact same way that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services uses it. The government uses it. They're, you know, the commercial insurance companies and their SIUs, where they're looking for aberrants and outliers and things of that nature. So there's been this trend and this availability of augmented intelligence. But what hasn't existed is something that provides clinical relevance to what providers are having to deal with at a patient's bedside, because everything is moving towards value-based care, evidence-based care. And you hear about these standards almost on a daily basis, right? And, you know, I spend a lot of my time in federal court, you know, both civil and criminal cases, where prosecutors will bring up things about evidence-based care, and they'll bring up things about medical necessity. So what is it specifically that you built, and why did you build it to focus really on that evidence-based care standard? Was there just nothing out there? Was there a lack of availability? Was there so much stuff that existed that you were trying to find a way to transport it into a central repository to make accessing this information easier? I mean, there had to be something that drove you to that process.
Yeah, I think it's multifactorial. Number one, when we started this journey, there wasn't other companies doing this. You know, there was just the EHRs, coding, billing. There wasn't, you know, decision support at scale built into the EHRs. What a lot of leading health systems were doing was taking their own instance of their EHR and spending tens of thousands of hours of time sort of building in their own decision support into that system. But at the end of the day, it wasn't scalable. It wasn't something that the hospital down the street could utilize because they had built it and customized it within their EHR environment. And so part of the mission with Evidence Care is let's democratize all of this. There's no reason why today with interoperability that we shouldn't be able to deliver the same information into different physicians' workflows and different EHRs, but still have it standardized. That's one component of it. The other component of it, you know, just touching on some of the topics you mentioned, the data aspect. We all know that payers have 10 times more data than the health systems or their providers have. And that's one of the problems, because we know that when we give physicians real-time data, they make better care decisions that are more value-based. But the problem is we're not giving them any real-time feedback right now. And so as physicians are caring for patients and they're making clicks in their EHR to place orders, it's a black box for them. You know, there's no feedback whatsoever. And so it'd be like having your kid do homework, but they don't know if they're getting the answers right or wrong. So they're never learning, you know? So that's where we need to be giving the doctors real-time feedback so that they can make better decisions and actually, you know, change some of that behavior that everybody's been wanting to figure out. How do we change clinician behavior? It all comes down to real-time feedback.
Yeah, you know, and I want to go back to something that you started talking about with electronic health records or electronic medical records. It's so critical for folks to understand that EHRs are nothing more than pages of templates that are created by non-clinical individuals, right? they're algebraic equations. We call them algorithms that take into consideration that if you do A and B, it should equal C or something to that effect. You have boxes that allow for free texting, but physicians and clinicians always ask the question of how much is enough? Am I putting too much? Am I not putting enough? So I think, you know, to your point, there's been no universal standard that has allowed, you know, this health system to engage with other health systems to develop clinical standards that have been updated from those standards that were derived in the 70s or 80s. You know, I remind people all the time that, you know, a couple of things. One, you know, they call it the practice of medicine for a reason. Right? Medicine's a it's not an exact science. So when we talk about evidence-based standards of care, sometimes we're talking about best practices, right? Because not every single patient is identical. Mm-hmm. Not every single patient, just because they have similar symptoms or signs, is going to wind up having the same diagnosis, which is why having published papers, having, you know, peer-reviewed information that's at a provider's fingertips is critical to them, at least in my non-clinical, you know, experience. Because you're right, it does afford a better, faster level of care that could be rendered to a patient when they're needing it the most. And you said something that was really profound earlier. You know, patients, unless they're frequent flyers, they don't go to the doctor. They don't go to the emergency room unless they're having the worst day of their life, right? Yep. You know, an emergency room needs to be thought of as just that, emergency care. And physicians, excuse me, or other qualified healthcare professionals, PAs, NPs, who are staffing these, you know, these trauma centers, these hospitals, these triage areas, need to have access to relevant medical information to help them better use their clinical judgment to determine the best course of care for patients to allow for the best possible outcome at the most value-based, you know, price, right? And I hate that we're even talking about price of care when it comes to, you know, rendering care, but it does come down to dollars and cents sometimes. So what kind of feedback and what kind of reaction have you been seeing in the marketplace to evidence care?
Yeah, we've been really fortunate that the feedback and the response has been very strong. And I think one of the things that we've done, because you're right, nobody likes to talk about compliance or money when you're talking about healthcare. So they kind of just navigate around it. But at the end of the day, it all comes back to compliance and finances. And for a while, you know, it's an early stage startup company, you know, we focused on just the clinical aspects. And, you know, we had doctors who love our platform and they want to use our platform, but it's when we actually started also focusing on compliance, operational efficiency, finances, margins, that the company just took off, because we're hitting all of those components. Yes, it starts with the care of the patient. Yes, it starts with helping make the physician's job easier. But the other side of it is when we help doctors make better care decisions and deliver better care, wow, surprise, it also has operational efficiency and financial and compliance impact for the hospital. So it all goes back to, you know, the physician, the nurse, the patient, and how are we doing the best we can. And so at the end of the day, now we shouldn't feel bad that we are improving compliance, improving operational efficiency, improving margins for the hospital, because that means that we're doing the right thing for the patient also.
So one of the questions I'm sure some of our folks are thinking about now is, will, you know, is this limited to emergency room physicians, or is this universal across the board? You know, what specialty would benefit the most from it, or do all specialties benefit from this program?
Yeah. So our focus has shifted a little bit. We started off focused on emergency physicians, built clinical pathways for emergency physicians. But our focus and target audience has sort of moved, I'll call it upstairs in the hospital, to sort of, you know, hospitalists and surgeons, just because some of the use cases that we've developed of tools, you know, are sort of focused on patients who are hospitalized. And obviously once a patient's hospitalized, the emergency physician's job is done. And now the patient's going to be cared for by those hospitalists, surgeons, you know, resident doctors. And so, yeah, our focus has shifted a little bit.
Okay. So I know one of the programs that you've created is oncology care. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've had a chance to take a look at the program, and it's pretty comprehensive, at least in what I'm able to look at superficially. Can you talk a little bit about oncology care and the, you know, understanding probably why it was created, but can you talk a little bit more about the program itself and really what it's doing?
Yeah, happy to. So oncology care is where we've taken our pathways engine and applied it to the specialty of cancer patients. And like any tool that we develop, you know, we go out and we partner with, you know, the leading medical society or health system on a particular topic. And so on that particular topic, we actually partnered with Moffitt Cancer Center, leading cancer institute down in Tampa, Florida. And sort of the quick story there was, you know, they're a leading cancer institute. They are sort of the leading Florida Institute for Cancer Care. So they are responsible to curate all of the latest evidence on cancer treatment and therapies, and compile that so that they can give recommendations to all the other hospitals in the state of Florida. About 5-6 years ago, they decided to take all that content. They developed over 50 guidelines. Every guideline is a 50 to 100 page PDF document. Every one of those pages probably takes about an hour to sit down and actually figure out what's actually going on this single piece of paper. And so it's tons of content, and it's impossible for any human being to actually review all that, remember it, apply it. So they went down the path of, well, let's build this into our EHR. So they spent several years and hired dozens of staff members to build this into the EHR. And they got to the point where they realized this is non-sustainable. We're never going to get there in terms of building all of these in the system. By the time we have them built, we have to go back and update them. The interface was very poor. The physician experience was very poor. And at the end of the day, one of the most important pieces for them was payer strategy. So they have agreements with payers in Florida that if they can document that a certain percentage of their patients are, quote, on pathway, then they get approval and don't have to go through a complicated process to get claims approved. They couldn't document
that. That's really
neat. Yeah, they couldn't document it. Even though they had built these pathways in the EHR, it wasn't capturing the data they needed. And so on the back end, they had to hire dozens of nurses to do manual chart audits to demonstrate whether the patient was on or off pathway. And so what we were able to do is build those pathways in our system. That system can now be deployed at any health system using any EHR, so democratizing that content. But at the same time as the physicians are using the tool, tracking whether that patient's on or off pathway, if that health system needs to be able to report that from a payer compliance perspective.
Yeah, I thought that was really neat. As I was looking at some of the screen grabs that you had, you know, trying to figure out on pathway, off pathway, your explanation now really helps clarify that and makes sense. You know, so what I view your program as is basically a bridge into the EMR, sort of like a PACS system, right? To where you have images that can be brought in from an outside third party, but yours is an outside platform that's bringing content into the EHR to allow providers faster access to information, to be able to allow them to make real-time decisions based on evidence-based medicine and clinical standards, or what we refer to as generally accepted standards of medical practice.
Yep. The way I think about it, Sean, the analogy I use is plumbing. So we built pipes into and out of the EHR. Out of, in terms of, we get all the data on the patient out of the EHR into our application. Our application can then place orders and documentation back into the EHR. And we surface this app not in a system outside the EHR. We actually surface it within the EHR, within the physician's workflow. So they're never leaving the EHR. But as we get data on the patient, we can help the physician with the treatment recommendations and management decisions that are relevant and evidence-based for that patient. And as they do that, it sends the orders and clinical documentation back into the EHR. Because those are two things that every physician has to do on every patient encounter. You have to place orders, you have to document. And so if you can help them do that more efficiently, while at the same time leading to better or correct care for that patient, well, then you're making the physician's workflow more efficient. You're helping them take better care of their patients, and then you're fulfilling everything else on the back end that we've already talked about.
Very cool. I want to talk about one other aspect of evidence care, and that is the admission care. Mm-hmm. So obviously, you know, again, it's not a portal. It is a bridge to evidence-based content that helps providers to make smarter decisions on what needs to be captured and placed into the electronic medical record to substantiate the placing of a patient into the inpatient setting. Is that a fair statement?
Absolutely. So it always comes down to mandates and payers. So what are the mandates and payers here? Well, when a physician hospitalizes a patient, it is the physician's mandate to place a bed status order on that patient. Basically, I need to say if that patient's inpatient or observation. And on top of that, I need to document in my clinical notes why I feel that that patient, especially if they're inpatient, has clinical severity of illness and medical necessity to fulfill that bed status determination. Okay, so doctors are required to do that. We are the last people that we should have doing this. Why? We never get any training in medical school or residency on bed status criteria. We certainly can't keep up with the 500-page book that changes every year. And so we're asking the least equipped members of the care team to be doing this. And so what happens many times is the physician flips a coin. I've had no less than 24 physicians in the last month tell me, I don't know what I'm doing. I flip a coin. I'm going to let somebody else fix it later. And so hospitals have to hire armies of UR nurses and case management and physician advisors to try to fix this issue. At the end of the day, the doctors are only causing more work to themselves, because if the patient is put in the wrong order or there's gaps in documentation, the UR case management or physician advisor team will eventually have to come back and find that physician because it is that doctor's note in the medical record that needs to reflect that patient's medical necessity. And so what we've done with this admission care tool is we've automated that process and we've empowered the physicians to do that correctly on the front end. So it's used by physicians at the time of admission decision, helps them determine the appropriate bed status for the patient. It automatically synchronizes the medical necessity documentation that the payers are looking for back into the physician's clinical notes. So it saves them 3 to 5 minutes that they, you know, would need to be spending typing or dictating all this into the medical record. And it really just closes the loop. And on the back end of this, you know, we're tracking all the analytics and KPIs around this. What we find is that we're getting patients in the appropriate bed status from a compliance perspective. We're reducing observation rates. We're reducing downgrades and denials. And we're helping to make the UR team more efficient because they're not having to spend the first half of every morning or every day evaluating those 30 patients that were admitted from the ER last night. Because the physicians are using the tool, getting the patients in the proper bed status, having proper documentation, and those UR teams can now be spending more time on concurrent reviews, more complicated patients, or, you know, writing denials audit letters.
Yep. So, you know, it's interesting because, you know, you talk about these policy manuals that continuously change. You know, if I'm not mistaken, there was not too long ago a change in another policy, the two-midnight rule. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So Levanta, that's one of the Medicare auditors, came out with some recommendations, as they do periodically, and unfortunately has just caused more confusion. You know, you'd hope that when they came out with these recommendations that it would help to clear things up. But in this case, it's made things more confusing. At the end of the day, the two midnight rule, you know, everybody thinks about it in sort of that temporal aspect of it's two midnights. But it's not really two midnights. It is the physician at the time of admission decision feeling that patient has medical necessity and care utilization requirements that may require that patient to stay for two midnights. Now, what's happened with all of this is, you know, if you go ask, you know, most physicians, what do they think of the two midnight rule? They say, well, I have no idea. I don't know if this patient's going to stay for two midnights. I don't want to be at Medicare compliance risk. I'm just going to put this patient in OBS for now, and I'm going to let somebody else figure it out later. And so what happens is it's not until that patient crosses two midnights that the health system puts them in inpatient status. Sometimes there's delays there. And so patient gets discharged, you know, before they convert them. And at the end of the day, the hospitals are losing out on a lot of revenue, and they're actually not in full compliance risk. Assurance.
Right.
The true way to interpret that rule is if the physician believes that patient has a clinical severity and medical necessity that requires resource utilization that may cross two midnights, that they are appropriate putting that patient in inpatient status on that initial determination. The big piece being they need to document that medical necessity and those reasons for that. Now, the problem there is most physicians think about patients as sick, need to stay, not sick, go home. And so when you ask a physician, well, what is it about this patient that you think has them meet medical necessity for two midnights? They'll say, I don't know, they're sick. And where they're lacking is, you know, really those being able to articulate and document those discrete criteria of this patient has pneumonia and they have X, Y, and Z risk factors and they are hypoxic and they have a complicated pleural effusion and they failed outpatient antibiotic therapy, and now documenting those reasons. And in those circumstances, even if that patient doesn't stay for two midnights, that hospital is compliant if they bill that out as inpatient, and they can, you know, appropriately fight that if it were to be denied, because that is the true intention of that mandate.
Yeah, these rules just get more complicated, more convoluted with each passing day. So I think that explanation was extremely beneficial.
Last thing I'll mention.
Yeah.
The problem with the rule is they tried to make it simple, but what they did is made it opaque. And when you can't have opaqueness or gray zones in healthcare. And so unfortunately they tried to make it so simple that they just introduced more confusion. Sorry.
No, I think that's great. You know, I was surfing around your website, you know, a little bit earlier, and one of the things that I thought was interesting was you have this section called the bottom line, and it says health systems are facing a historic challenge, which I don't think anybody could dispute. And it's between shortages, meaning in staff, physicians, clinicians in general, burnout and inefficiency plaguing clinical workforces, and it puts more pressure on already thin margins for hospital administration. Modern clinical decision technology needs to deliver both better care and financial return on investment. And then you give a percentage, and it's 48% decline in hospital operating margins since the pandemic began. What are you talking about there?
Yeah, so you know, we're part of several industry groups, you know, that look at hospital margins, and have been tracking those over the last, you know, 10, 15, 20 years. Definitely health systems were hit really hard during COVID. I'm actually surprised that percentage number isn't higher, because at the end of the day, most health systems went to margin rate of zero.
And I agree with you. That's why I thought it was so interesting.
Yeah. You know, we are starting to see some health systems, you know, come out of the woods on this. You know, hopefully a lot of them took their medicine last year, so that they can, you know, go into 2024, with a little bit stronger balance sheets and operating budgets. But you know, there's been several articles on this over the last few months. You know, health systems can't survive on 0% margins. And, you know, something's going to have to, change. And, you know, we think a big aspect of this is, you know, revenue is not going up. You talk to most CFOs and you get them a few drinks, they'll say, you know, we're projecting flat revenue over the next 10 years. So the only way that we're going to achieve margins is if we start looking at cost of care, and figuring out how we deliver the right care to the patient in an efficient manner that helps assure the best outcomes, but at the same time, you know, is reducing cost of care and making us more efficient as a health system and as a delivery vehicle for the community.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think you're spot on your analysis. And, you know, I look forward to hopefully having some more conversations with you. I want to thank Dr. Brian Fengler for joining me today on the Compliance Guy podcast. If you'd like more information on Evidence Care, their platform, and how they can integrate into your EHR, you can visit them at Evidence Care or evidence.care. I'm always so used to putting a .com or dot something after it. So it's evidence.care. Dr. Fengler, I want to say again, thank you so much for taking time out of your very busy schedule to sit down with me and for our audience to get an opportunity to learn more about yourself, more about what drove you into the analytics of healthcare and helping providers to be better clinicians. So again, thank you for that.
Absolutely, Sean. Really appreciate the opportunity to be on your show. And look forward to staying in touch.
Absolutely. All right, that's going to take us to the end of this program today. As always, I want to thank y'all for tuning in, logging on, and hanging out with me and my special guest just for a little while. I will make sure in the description of today's podcast to get you a link to Evidence Care. But once again, it's evidence.care. Again, it is an EHR integrated platform helping to transform clinical decisions. All right. I'll be back later this week with some more Compliance Guy podcasts. So until then, remember, be good to yourself. But more importantly, y'all be good to each other. Take care.
You've been listening to The Compliance Guy. Sean has been doing this for 28 years. He holds 10 national board certifications. He's a partner and the vice president of compliance for Doctors Management, LLC. He's a subject matter expert in federal court. He's lectured at the most prestigious institutions. He's engaged with members of Congress in both chambers. So what we're saying is he's qualified? We hope you've enjoyed the show. Make sure to like, rate, and review. And we'll be back soon. But in the meantime, you can find us on social media @The Compliance Guy. See you next time on The Compliance Guy.